watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Lately, the media is full of images of cheering campaign supporters as candidates vie for their party's nominations. But many have noticed that the candidates of either party who dared to make substantive critique of the political economy from either the right or the left have been conspicuous by their absence in major corporate media outlets and have been marginalized by their own party leaderships as well. Their critiques and views, it seems, have strayed too close to the heart of the system. A Robin Hood in reverse affair where the power of the state is used to transfer wealth from the many at the bottom of the economic pyramid to those at the top, belying the rhetoric of free markets. This week, the program is devoted to a recent talk by an award-winning investigative reporter who has delved into how the laws and regulations make this possible, as well as the spin and misleading language that serves to obfuscate what is actually happening. David K. Johnston has a long career as an investigative journalist and joined the New York Times in 1995. Recently, his work has focused on the subject of taxation. His most recently published book, Free Lunch: How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, is an exposé of hidden subsidies, rigged markets, and what has been called corporate socialism. It follows on his previous book, Perfectly Legal: The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else, which was a New York Times bestseller. Johnston received the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting for, quote, his penetrating and enterprising reporting that exposed loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, which was instrumental in bringing about reforms, close quote. In his long career, he's worked for various major daily papers around the country and studied economics at the University of Chicago and elsewhere. He now lives near Rochester, New York, where he spoke on February 16th at an event sponsored by the Rochester Labor Lyceum, an organization that has presented public talks and debates on topics of labor and social justice since 1897. Here's David K. Johnston.
My goodness, thank you for all coming. This is terrific. I've sometimes flown across the country and had 25 people turn up, so I appreciate this. You know, 28 years ago, Ronald Reagan asked the question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? I'm here to ask the question, are you better off than you were in 1980?
Yeah.
I'm going to help you remember. Now, on one level, the country is much better off. More than half the national wealth has been created since 1980. In real terms, we are more than twice as wealthy today as we were in 1980. Per person, adjusted for inflation, For every dollar the economy put out in 1980, it is putting out roughly $1.70 today. So how come you're not all flush with cash, free of debt, have better fringe benefit plans that you had back then, better health care plans, and better retirement plans? Where's the beef? Remember that from 1980? Where's the beef? Where'd all that money go? What the hell happened? That's what Free Lunch is about. Free Lunch is a book that people who don't want you to hear this message start calling me a leftist and a Marxist and an enemy of capitalism. It is a book about, in fact, defending free markets, and which cites throughout it classic conservative virtues taken from Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, and whose name is invoked continually in this era for our economic policies, because he's the one who figured out that it is markets that create economic growth, not acts of charity. The Bible, and of all people, Andrew Mellon. And if I forget in the next 75 minutes while I talk, or 70 minutes about Andrew Mellon, please make sure somebody asks me that when you ask questions. All right? Well, go back to 1980 for a moment. Let's remember what happened. America had come through an era in which we had unbelievable prosperity driven by a stock market bubble and speculation in the late 1920s. The top 10%, the top 1%, the top half of 1%, the top 10th of 1%, the top 100th of 1% all had growing share of the income. And then we had the crash. And we had all those years of economic turmoil and trouble. And coming out of World War II, we have this notion that the war wasn't over. There was a Cold War. A whole lot of people who wanted to go invade Russia, just like Napoleon did, and probably would have had similar success. But during the period after the war, we had a government with bipartisan agreement that focused on developing and nurturing a middle class, on creating economic stability in people's lives. We had the GI Bill. Enormous explosion in the number of men with college degrees. Enormous explosion. We had VA loans, GI loans, 30-year mortgages that allowed people to buy their own houses and finance them over time and put some economic stability in their lives. The movie they show every year at Christmas by Frank Capra, It's a Wonderful Life, that was a very good depiction of life in the 30s, where, you know, cruel old Mr. Potter rented all the property, and you had to live in a crummy apartment unless somehow you could put the money together through the building and loan, as they called it, to build your own house. Things went along very well. We had enormously high tax rates. The highest marginal tax rate in the 1950s was 91%. However, you should know that it only applied to capital income, not wage income. Capital income meaning gains from selling something at a higher price than you paid for it, dividends, interest, and almost nobody paid it. Ronald Reagan asserts that he paid it. Everybody else hired a good tax lawyer and paid less. Well, for the bottom 90% of Americans, based on tax data, incomes in this country peaked in 1973. That's 35 years ago. 35 years ago, I had little children and black hair, and I weighed 100 pounds less. 35 years ago, man, you could pay a house off with a 30-year mortgage and have 5 more years to put money away. That's a long period of time. In the year 2005, that's the latest year we have data for, the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans was, ready for this? $74 a week less in real terms than it was in 1973. That's almost $4,000. And what happened in 1973, anybody remember? Oil. Was our first experience with the role of oil in gasoline lines and what could happen and how dependent we had become on oil. Well, the economy stopped growing. We got stagflation. One of the buzzwords of the 70s, stagflation. Inflation, stagnant growth. And so Mr. Reagan came along in 1980, aided somewhat by the fact that our embassy had been overrun in Iran, and ran for office on this argument, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And Mr. Reagan famously said, government is the problem. And he told us that markets were the solution. Now, Ronald Reagan was a very smart guy. He played a sort of dumb, ambling character to the public. But he was a very smart guy. But he was not a detail guy. He was not a Jimmy Carter. He wasn't a policy wonk. He thought about big issues. And the big issues he saw were bringing down the commies in Moscow, building up the military, and cutting taxes, and this new word that was introduced into our lexicon, deregulation. Well, so what's happened? It's been 28 years. That's more than enough time for us to make some assessment of what took place. We were all told government would get smaller. Taxes would be less. We'd be better off. We'd make more money. None of those things have happened. Government as a share of the economy has not changed. The only thing that's changed is that government has gone from taxing and spending to taxing and borrowing and spending. To the point where this year, approximately all of the individual income taxes that you have withheld from your income stream from January through the end of April will just go to pay interest on the national debt. When Mr. Reagan took office, the national debt was less than $1 trillion, just about $1 trillion. When Mr. Bush leaves office, it will be roughly $10 trillion. 86% of the income that we put in the tax system comes from wages and deferred wages, a pension, a 401k plan. Those are deferred wages. Well, think about what that means then. When the government borrows money, it is explicitly taxing people on their labor to pay interest to capital. It is an explicit transfer from labor to capital. And so the more the government borrows, the better off the people with capital are. Any of you watch Jane Austen movies or read Jane Austen's book? She's, after all, the most read writer in history, I'm told. Well, there are all these discussions about, oh, Mr. Darcy has 10,000 and Mr. So-and-so, he has 5,000. What they're talking about is the amount of capital they had that they loaned to the state and the annual pounds they collected in interest. Well, that's what we're doing. We've created a system here to tax you on your labor or your deferred labor income to funnel money to capital. Now, we've done something related to this through government policy. We've adopted a whole host of policies under the guise of deregulation. Now, deregulation to most people means, well, the government's going to get out of the way. We're just going to have a free market. You constantly, if you turn on the radio, if you turn to CNBC, if you read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, you will constantly hear free markets, free markets, free markets. There is no such thing. Everything has rules. Baseball has rules on how many stitches there are in the baseball. There are rules on where your car has to stop when you come to an intersection. And if you cross that line, you can get a ticket. Everything has rules. So we didn't get deregulation. We got new regulation. And we got new regulation written by, on behalf of, and serving the interests of the people who are subject to the regulations. And I'll come back to this in a minute. Now, another thing that's happened is that we have created the most inefficient, inexpensive healthcare system in the world. In Free Lunch, I cite as my source, what I'm about to tell you, the CIA. Now, the CIA may be doing a lousy job of gathering real-time intelligence about perceived enemies, but they are really good at analyzing things like train schedules, how much coal is being mined in Outer Mongolia, and things like that. They're really good at that. Nobody questions their ability. So what does the CIA say about our healthcare system in the CIA fact book? Well, by many measures of healthcare, we rank below Cuba and with such leading countries of the world as Croatia. And yet, we spend far more money than the Europeans, the Canadians, the Japanese, the New Zealanders and the Australians on our healthcare system. We spend more money in absolute terms, we spend more money per person, and yet one out of seven Americans, mostly poor people, does not have health care. And the constant cry is socialized medicine. That, of course, is what every member of Congress has. It's what the President of the United States has. It's what every government employee has. It is what everybody who reaches 65 has. Now, the other day, you may have heard President Bush say, you know, this isn't true that people can't get health care. You can always go to the emergency room. Forget the economics of that, and then we'll go back to President Bush's knowledge of economics later on. The fact is that I was sitting on an airplane the other day. I spent an enormous amount of time in airplanes, traveling around the country. And the person next to me said, I don't understand all this about people that have health care. I mean, I said, well, what if you get cancer? And they said, well, if you get cancer, the government takes care of you. I said, you're right. The government will provide you with free health care if you don't have it, if you get cancer. Do you know when? Well, when they find out you have cancer. I said, no. When you get to what's called stage three and become totally disabled. In other words, when it's more likely than not that you will die. That's when our government suddenly says, oh, we will provide health care for you. Now, if health care as a business worked, I would be the first guy to say this is terrific. I was introduced as a reporter for a newspaper. I'm also the chairman of the board of a little family company. It's a pipsqueak company, $2 million of revenue. We manage hotels. We're about to double our business. I have a lot of ambitions for this little company my oldest son and I run. But we have a healthcare system, if it worked as a business, would be great. But, you know, we used to have another model that should tell us why it wouldn't work. In the 1800s, we had fire insurance, not the kind you have today. In the 1800s, you hired an independent corporation to fight a fire if your house or your business caught fire. So my house is just fine, but my neighbor's house catches fire. My fire insurance company is at the end of the block. His is 2 miles away. My fire insurance company won't come. They won't fight the fire. They're not there to fight his fire. His house is fully engulfed by the time his company gets there. And now the fire takes my house because it's so hot, and we both lose our houses. It did not take long. It took about a decade for people to figure out this was a stupid system. And so what did we get? You know that we have socialized fire departments?
Yes.
By the way, we also have socialized police departments and socialized kindergarten and socialized parks and socialized roads. Now, to some people, this is an anathema. Milton Friedman, the great economist, from whose phrase and whose popularizing of the idea that there's no such thing as a free lunch, I took the title of my book, said, you know, people have this idea we're a society. We're not a society. We're 300 million people who just occupy the same geography. Really? I mean, does anybody here think that? Oh, okay, well, there's always one in every crowd. I think almost everywhere in the world experience has shown we're social animals. Mr. Friedman, who was Barry Goldwater's campaign advisor in 1964, wanted to eliminate all public parks. All public parks. The only things he was willing to concede were like small urban parks because it's impossible to efficiently put up a toll gate and control who enters and charge them. And God forbid some little child somewhere goes on a swing they didn't pay for. I, in free lunch, examine, well, what happens if we think of ourselves as a society? If we have rules that grease the wheels of commerce, that make things easier, that result in a well-educated population. We've all had the experience of going to buy something from a store clerk who functionally illiterate. McDonald's and other companies have put little icons on the cash register because we've cut spending on schools. There's a young man I mentioned in this book from the inner city of Rochester. I've been helping with college, and I kept trying to help him learn how to read. And one day, he suddenly tells me about Moby Dick. And I thought, well, that's astonishing that he could read Moby Dick because he couldn't read all these much easier things I gave him. And he said, oh, I didn't read Moby Dick. I said, what'd you do? He says, well, they showed the movie. I said, well, what did you read? Did and I not knocked off some novels? And he went, no, all they did all through high school. We never read a book. They just showed movies. This apparently has gone on all over the country. It should be an enormous scandal. And yet, nothing about it. Now, one of the most far-reaching things that's happened in our economy are rules and laws that force you to pay taxes that never get to government. Taxes that are instead used for the benefit of wealthy people. The wealthiest family in America are the Waltons. They control Walmart. They're worth, as a family, more than $100 billion. Well, according to one of their spokesmen, when they build a new Walmart store, in about 1 in 3 cases, they try to get the following deal. The sales tax you pay at the cash register never goes to the government. Now, they don't literally get to put it in their pocket. That would be too simple. Instead, the money is turned over to a government agency which buys bonds, which bought the land, which built the building, which leases it for virtually nothing to the Walmart company through a subsidiary that's in a state that has no state taxes, so they don't have to pay any state taxes in your state. And when the bonds are paid off, they own the store free and clear, purchased for them by you. Not because of the market, but because they got this special deal. Now, there are two ways to think about this. The first one is the obvious one. This means that your police department, your fire department, your schools, your libraries are not getting those tax dollars. The argument made is, well, but they wouldn't get them anyway because this is what's called tax increment financing. Would anybody think that tax increment financing means the sales tax you pay doesn't get to the government? That give you a clue as to what it is? No. Well, for that theory to be true, one of two things has to happen. Either the population and the wealth of a community grows and there's more spending, so it may work in a rapidly growing community, but then the market should provide the demand for the new store. Or every time a new grocery store opens in town, if you're a Tops customer, you go buy a can of soup there, and then you go to the new market and buy a second one, right? We all do that. Sure. It's a phony theory. And by the way, they try to get a second deal that they usually get. Exemption from property taxes for 7 to 10 years. So you're paying these heavy, heavy property taxes here, and there are profitable businesses that aren't. I calculated from their own public statement how much over a period of, it's in the book, but I think it's 15 years, the Waltons paid, the Walmart company paid in property taxes compared to a homeowner who makes $50,000 a year. And if you were paying at the rate that they are, your property tax bill would be $10 a month, $120 a year. No wonder they're profitable. But remember, I said there were two ways to think about this. Here's the second one. You went into business. You own a little store. And you've used your own money, your own hard work. You've built up this enterprise. You've invested in it. You haven't sucked dry of capital because you needed to keep the business going. And suddenly, your own town fathers, your own county legislature or supervisors, your own state legislature give this national competitor all this money to open up across the street from you. An enormous subsidy. And one of the stories I tell in free lunch is about a guy named Jim Weeknecht, who lives in the Poconos. He had a little outfitting club for hunters and fishermen. Tiny store, 2,100, 2,200 square feet. 6 or 7 employees. He made enough money that his wife, Julie, could stay home and raise their 3 kids. And to Jim Weeknecht, that was just fine. That was all the success he cared for. And then one day, in this little town of 4,100 people, he hears that Cabela's is going to come to town. Cabela's sells the same stuff, hunting and fishing gear. And they want $32 million. And here's how much $32 million is to that town. It is more than the entire city budget for 10 years. It is enough money to buy every family in that town a car. It's about $24,000 per family. And Weeknecht says, this is madness. He also says, you know, if I had $1 million from City Hall, I could build like a really successful business. Of course, if I went down to City Hall and said, give me $1 million, they'd laugh at me. They'd throw me out of here. But they gave Cabela's $32 million because Cabela said, if we build this store in the middle of the Poconos, People will come from New York and Connecticut and Washington, D.C., and Western Pennsylvania, and they're all going to drive, and there are going to be hotels built and restaurants. And somebody said, well, wait a minute. You're not building down our historic little downtown on the side of the freeway that nobody stops at. You're going to build on this pad across the way, a mile and a half away. And somehow they came up with the brilliant idea that, well, they just run a free trolley. So after you bought your hunting and fishing gear, you could go over to the little downtown. And Jim Winkneck said, why would you drive a day or two to buy a fishing reel when you can get everything Cabela sells except rifles out of their catalog? But here's the real rub about it. How did Jim Winkneck survive as a tiny business all these years? He kept a Cabela's catalog at the cash register in the front of his store. And whenever anybody would question the price he wanted to charge for a hunting bow or a jacket or a fishing rod, he would pull out the Cabela's catalog and say, well, see, my price is lower. He was more efficient. In fact, many times local sellers are more efficient and charge lower prices. That's why in New York City, if you go down to the Bargain District on the Lower East Side, any day of the week except Saturday, you can buy things for a lot less than anywhere else in the city. They're very efficient operators. Well, there's another device that's used to suck money out of you whether you take part in it. How many people in this room have a burglar alarm? About 1 in 5, maybe? People agree? 1 in 10? Nationally, 1 in 5 houses has a burglar alarm. Now, that's kind of odd because your odds of being burglarized today are half what they were in 1980. Crime has gone down, and the population has increased. So your chances of being burglarized are half what they were in 1980. But the burglar alarm business has exploded. Now, you've all seen these ads on TV. There's that cute little Hollywood beautiful mother. Now, Hollywood's an amazing place. They think Ernest Borgnine is an ugly man. There's this mother standing there with her little ones gathered around, and suddenly they show a guy at the front door. You know, he's got a Bowie knife in his mouth. And it's aimed at the head of the household, the father, that he should be worried about this. And then suddenly you hear this sound, and the lights come on, and the narrator in the ad says, and because you bought a burglar alarm, the police are on their way. Well, that's a description of a $2 billion a year subsidy. Because when the police go to check out that burglar alarm, it costs money. On average, it costs $50. Tyco, the center of the Wall Street scandals, gets 1/4 of that subsidy, $500 million a year of free labor. Now, some of you are undoubtedly saying to yourself, wait a minute, the police should respond to burglar alarms. That's a proper function of the police. Well, let's think about that for a minute. 4 out of 5 houses don't have a burglar alarm. So they're being taxed to provide a service that only 1 out of 5 houses gets. Secondly, studies by the Justice Department show that having a dog, even a golden retriever, is about equal to a burglar alarm in keeping burglars at bay. Third, the average burglary takes 5 minutes. The average police response to a burglar alarm takes about a half an hour. They virtually never arrest anybody. They arrest at 1/10 the rate of patrol officers in patrol cars, which is itself a very inefficient way to do policing. We've all been accustomed to it because of long history, but it's not a useful use of your tax dollars. As they've done experiments where they just remove all the police cars and crime doesn't change. Now, I am not saying you shouldn't be able to have a burglar alarm. If you have a burglar alarm, that's fine. But let's have the market pay for the system. The burglar alarm companies typically charge $29 or $30 a month for burglar alarm service, which really means they put a little device about this long, size of my little finger, on your telephone line, and if the burglar alarm is tripped, it sends a signal to a computer technician. It comes up with information. He makes a phone call. If you don't answer or you don't answer and give the right answer his questions with the right answers, they call the police. The profit margin on the burglar alarm monitoring business, according to the industry's own statistics, is 77%. Now, just to make sure you understand the perspective on that, business as a whole in the United States counts, depending on the economy, 9 to 11 cents, tilted toward 11 cents, out of each dollar as profit. This is off-the-wall profitable. because there's no expense. This is what I call economic pollution. It is no different than environmental pollution. In environmental pollution, the smokestack or the drain pipe takes the company's toxic wastes and makes the rest of us endure it through dirty air, unsafe water, or some other negative effect. And what these companies are doing is taking their real costs of operating their business and throwing it off, polluting the economy, and making you pay their costs. And of all the things I've written about in Free Lunch, by the way, the most sustained attack I'm getting is from the burglar alarm industry. They're getting letters posted. They're calling every radio and TV show I show up on. They never tell people they're from the industry, though. Only because somebody knew who some of the names were did I find out that these were really people in the industry. Now, here we are in Rochester, New York, an hour and a half from Niagara Falls, with all of that electricity being generated. And yet, you know, we get virtually none of it, unless you live in Fairport. And the state of New York is about to make a deal with the oldest aluminum plant in America. It may have finished the deal by now. To sell them discounted electricity for 30 years. It is the functional equivalent of the state of New York writing a check to this one company for $5.6 billion. You think, I don't care how big your company is, you think if the government handed you $5.6 billion, you might make a nice profit? You're not competing in the market. You're saying that little businesses and all the small manufacturing things that have gone away because of various costs around here, including electricity, aren't going to have that power. So this one company, and the cost of saving those jobs is roughly $148,000 each. Now, this is something we do all over the country. And who do we give that money to? Well, last year, Warren Buffett owns Geico Insurance through his holding company. You know, the cavemen and the little lizard. Over in Buffalo, where they have the highest urban unemployment in the state of New York, they gave his company a gift of $100 million to create a call center. These are not jobs that pay a lot of money. People who are going to deal with problems people have with their insurance. The Buffalo News ran a feature about the way to get a career going and become an executive is to start out working in a call center. We all laugh and think that's silly. Guess who owns the Buffalo News? Warren Buffett. And it didn't create any jobs. Why? Because a Canadian firm that owned a similar center with about as many workers as Mr. Buffett intends to have shut down just as his was opening up. And it didn't do anything for the high unemployment rate in downtown Buffalo because they built it in one of the whitest suburbs of Buffalo, a place with virtually no bus service from the inner city. And this is part of a pattern. Donald Trump, last year, or in 2006, I guess it was in 2006, got $89 million for his casinos from a tax the state of New Jersey imposes specifically for the poor. Now, the last time I looked, Donald Trump was not holding himself out to be impoverished. In fact, he's suing one of my colleagues at the New York Times for writing in a book that he's not a billionaire. When I wrote that he had a negative net worth of $600 million in 1990, he probably would have liked to sue me. The problem was that I had his own personal financial net worth statement that showed what he said he was worth and his bankers said he was worth. One way to think about this is, at least at that time, you were probably worth more than Donald Trump. All throughout our society, we are creating rules. Rules that the news media have either not written about or written about with an utter lack of clarity. Tax increment financing. That are taking money out of your pocket. Lots of money. And giving it to rich people and large corporations, even when you don't do business with them. How many of you know that the Rhino Stadium, which you've been reading about, is in trouble? You know who's been paying the bond interest on those?
We have.
When Tom Fry was on a citizens committee to look at the viability of this project, he kept being denied information. And finally, he just said, I just have one question. All I want to know is, how much ticket revenue? How much did you get from actual paying fans? and they wouldn't say. So you and I are paying for this. Now, some people argue that this is essentially Joe Sixpack's government subsidy. Government gives money to art museums, not much. It gives money to live theater like Jiva. I'm on the board of Jiva. I think we get about 1% of our budget from government. But that's the argument that's made. But I want you to think about the size of these things. George Steinbrenner is having a new Yankee Stadium built in the Bronx. Initially, he insisted there was no subsidy. Then the New York Independent Budget Office said, well, it's at least $200 and some million. Then it went to $3 something, and then $4 something. We now know it's over $600 million, and we don't know all the terms of the deal. The Mets have an almost identical deal. Here's what we do know, because Wayne Barrett of the Village Voice dug this out. He's regarded by many people as the best local reporter in New York City. Rudy Giuliani gave the Mets and the Yankees $25 million each to lobby government to get subsidies. So you are being taxed to give money to these people to argue against your interest. But that's not the biggest deal. The really outrageous one is the Washington Nationals. When the Montreal Expos were transferred to Major League Baseball's owners, and then the franchise was moved to Washington, Major League Baseball sold the team for $450 million. Roughly, the other baseball team owners made a doubling of their profit because they had about $240 million in the deal. Well, a $450 million investment, that sounds like a big investment. A lot of jobs, a lot of money. Well, except the city of Washington, D.C., one of the poorest cities in the country, the city of Washington, D.C. is giving them a stadium worth $611 million. And they let the owners have the naming rights to the stadium. So it'll be called something like, you know, we have Frontier Field here. That's worth $400 million. Let's see. 611, 400, that's a billion plus. Cost of the team, 450 million. Oh, my God. We paid these guys over $500 million to buy the team. Holy mackerel. They don't have any money in the deal. Kind of like the Rhinos deal, as best anybody can tell. And maybe, because nobody has ever asked the question, like the Fast Ferry deal. If you look at Hevesy's audit, you look at the lawsuit Dutch Schultz bought, everybody stops the minute you get to the end of the government's accounting, and nobody's issued subpoenas and said, we want to see your books on the other side. We want to know what happened to the money that you got. Where'd it go? It's public money. If you lost a lot of money, fine. You made an investment and failed. But if, in fact, you got rich off this deal, we ought to know about it, even if we can't get it back. Well, let me tell you how George Bush made his fortune. George Bush is among the 1 in 1,000, actually about the 1 in 600 wealthiest people in America. He's not that wealthy. He's worth about $15 million. May sound like a lot of money to you, but in the world of wealth, that's nothing. Okay? I point out in the book that Forbes magazine says we have one billionaire here in Rochester. I went around and interviewed a lot of people and concluded that there are at least 4, maybe 7, and I've since had 2 leading citizens in town come talk to me and suggest that there probably are 9 billionaires living in the Rochester area. There are absolutely 4. Well, George Bush was a tax shelter salesman. You know, you hear all these stories, he had oil and gas drilling operations in Midland, Texas. What that really means is he was selling tax shelters. That's what people do who buy these things. And he was lousy at it. This is work that requires intense attention to detail. And whether you love George Bush or you hate George Bush, I think everybody knows this man is not, you know, he's not Jimmy Carter. Probably would have done really well if he had gone into that business. In addition, of course, this was when, by his own admission, he was drinking wildly. And as I point out in the book in a sort of backhanded way, he's admitted that up until 1974, he had another problem. Well, one day, a guy named Eddie Childs, 89 years old, he's looking at the clock and realizing his time is coming to an end. He owns the Texas Rangers baseball team. It's a little money-losing hobby. His kids don't want it. So he needs to unload this thing to straighten up his affairs. He puts it up for sale. Some out-of-towners are going to buy it. Immediately an uproar somehow arises in Texas. The Texans must buy this. We can't have outsiders buying our Texas Rangers. Up steps George W. Bush. Happens to have a father with a very interesting address in Washington and a golden Rolodex. And he puts together a group of investors who live in places like Beverly Hills, New York City, and Westchester County, and Connecticut. And they buy the team. And he tells them, listen, this is a really sweet deal. All we have to do is get a new stadium. Now, these guys, some of the guys who invest in steel are billionaires. Some of them are movie makers. George Bush had invested with two of these guys in a movie that's been described as the most bloody, vicious movie to ever come out of Hollywood, The Hitcher, starring Rutger Hauer. Big story about it in the LA Times. And George Bush was an investor in that film with two of the owners of the Rangers. And Bush told his partners, all we have to do is get a stadium built. Now, these guys could have built their own stadium. They've got deep pockets. They got plenty of money. They can go to a bank and have no trouble, but they didn't want to do that. Instead, they financed a special election held on an odd date in January. They hired a group of political consultants. These turned out to be Democrats, by the way, because all of the things I'm describing here are bipartisan in their nature. And this election passes, and they raise the sales tax in Arlington, Texas, a city of about 300,000 people midway between Fort Worth and Dallas. That money is then used to finance bonds to build a ballpark. And by the way, it's a gorgeous ballpark. It's just a fantastic ballpark. Now, in a market economy, and President Bush is a big promoter, he says, of market economies, you want to build something, you go into the market and you start assembling pieces of land. And the person who holds out, who becomes the last person to sell, often gets an incredible, extraordinary price. All throughout my career, I've read stories about somebody who owned, you know, a one-foot-wide strip of land somewhere that was needed to finish a deal, and they got $10 million for it. If you go to Las Vegas and go to the Mirage, in the middle of the parking lot of the Mirage, you will see an apartment building owned by a guy named Mike Flores. And in my first book, Temples of Chance, back in 1992, I wrote about this. He knew that they were going to need this land to build the Mirage, and he waited and waited for the market forces and figured he'd make a killing, and one day they offered him $1 million. And he said, wait a second, I'm making $120,000 a year out of this building. If I bought bonds, I'd lose half my income. You got to pay me $5 million. And Steve Wynn said, okay, we'll just build a parking lot around you. We don't care. We'll leave a little access road for you. And so to this day, in the middle of that parking lot, there's that building, and he never got his money. He took a risk in the market. He made the wrong bet. That's not what George Bush did. He got the government to go after the land he coveted and to seize it by government's power of eminent domain, which comes from the Constitution. Now, the Constitution says land seized for public purposes, which most of us tend to think about as roads, military bases, saving a swamp so that there's fish growing out in the ocean or in the river. But the Supreme Court has held that public purposes also include economic development. And just compensation, the requirement in the Constitution, is a synonym for discount, really deep discount. Most people just took what they could get and sold out. One family fought back. A lot of people in this room are old enough to remember Curtis Mathis televisions in the 50s.
Right.
That's the family that held out. They didn't want to sell their horse ranch. They went to court. A jury awarded them six times what the city said their land was worth, plus interest. Six times. Well, the subsidy for this deal, according to the public records and Ray Hutchison, a Republican insider, the husband of Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, Republican of Texas, and a personal friend of George Bush, who was the lawyer on the deal and who is the leading authority on municipal bond finance in Texas. He told me the subsidy was worth $202.5 million. When the team was sold, the profit reported by the investors, George Bush and the others, was $164 million. Let's see, subsidy $202 million, gain, what happened to that $38 million? That's why subsidies don't work. They didn't capture it. George Bush, the NBA president, did not add $1 to the value of that team. Only the taxpayers did. Now, President Bush has always said this was a win-win for everybody. Well, let's think about that for a minute. The vast majority of people in this country never go to a baseball game. And the vast majority of people in Arlington, Texas never go to a baseball game. But everybody was taxed. Little children who took the money they made from their allowance or from babysitting or mowing lawns and went to buy crayons or Nintendo games or whatever, they were taxed to give money to George Bush and his partners, all rich men. Fundamental to all of the things I've been talking about is that we have a government that has changed from the era after World War II up till 1980 of developing and nurturing a middle class, creating stability, creating broad prosperity, to a government whose de facto policy, that is, its unstated but actual policy, is to take from the many to give to the few. That's the case, I argue, in free lunch. Now, there was a review of my book in the New York Times a week ago Sunday that said, well, that's just not true. We soak the rich to help people at the bottom. Net transfers in the United States of cash flows, top to bottom, 3% of the economy. Europe, 6, 7, 8%, depending on what country you're in. 3%. And we have no measures of the devices that I'm telling you about. I spent a lot of my own money. For one chapter alone in my book, I spent $2,500 on photocopying so we could prove one of the devices. We had to find a single sentence, and there was no practical way to do it except photocopy $2,500 worth of papers and then go through and find it. And all of the stuff in my book comes from either official government documents, the people that I'm writing about, lawsuits, which I guess are official government documents, corporate records. And I give you chapter and verse, location, place, you know, where these things came from. And if anybody finds something and they want to know more about, tell me, and we'll put the document up on my website, freelunchthebook.com. We've done one. There's supposed to be a second one up there. Two so far readers have asked about. By the way, tomorrow the New York Times is running my letter to the editor about the review and his response, and a letter from somebody else about the review. There's one other industry I want to talk about. Again, that's electricity, because it is the core of modern life is electricity. A couple of years ago, my wife and I and my two youngest children went to Pompeii. And you walk around Pompeii and Herculaneum, or you walk around the cities that still exist in southern France, and the most striking feature is that these people were exactly like us. They had bars and restaurants and hair salons, and the layout of how the bars were was amazingly like a lot of bars in America today. Now, this being ancient Rome, they're a little different in that they had all these whorehouses. But that's just a cultural difference. But there are two things you're struck by. They didn't have internal combustion engines. So the scale of everything is the scale of a modern suburban mall. If anything, it's a little narrower than a suburban mall because people could walk everywhere. The advantage is, of course, you can walk all the way across town in a couple of minutes. Not like if you wanted to walk all the way across even Rochester. The other thing is they didn't have electricity. Other than that, they're no different than us. People are people. We haven't really evolved in the biological sense in the last 5,000 years. Well, what's happened to electricity? In the 1970s, big industrial customers, manufacturing plants, automakers, people like that, complained that the system of regulating electricity prices was unfair to them. They didn't argue that the prices were unfair. What they argued was that they were being charged more than they should because they were big volume users, and that you as homeowners and small business owners were not paying enough. In effect, they said, we're subsidizing you. They didn't get very far with this argument until they ran into a guy named Ken Lay. Ken Lay sent teams of people out all over the country to lobby for new laws, and their argument was this. The distribution of electricity is a natural monopoly. I mean, anybody want to have 18 sets of wires running down their street? There are actually about six cities in America that have two sets of wires running down their street, and they look awful. But they said generation of electricity. That's not a natural monopoly. So let's create a market. Let's go to Adam Smith's idea here. that markets will produce the greatest benefit, that the invisible hand of the market, as each producer tries to be as efficient and effective as they can at selling their product, will result in the lowest possible price to the consumer. So we're going to create electricity markets, and then they can sell to the utilities. Well, 26 of the states went for this. And I retell how this bill was passed in Texas as the story of the Siege of Troy. It's got all the characters. I mean, it's got Laocoon, it's got Cassandra, it's even got Odysseus. And these laws were passed, and what happened is that in Texas, electricity prices doubled. They didn't go down, they doubled. In fact, I show in the book that at times, electricity that utilities were, that generators were willing to give away, because if you have a nuclear power plant, it's got to run 24 hours a day at a steady state. If you have a really big coal plant, you basically have to run it 24 hours a day at a steady state. So they would offer to give power away at low demand times, say March, 2 o'clock in the morning, or maybe $1 for a megawatt. And the typical price for electricity should be $35, $60 a megawatt, depending on where you live in the country and the mix of fuels. But the way these markets were designed by Enron caused people to pay as much as $990. And here's how that worked. Let's say that you wanted to buy the land I mentioned, George Bush, at the where you wanted to build a ballpark. You go around and buy up pieces of land and have people do it on your behalf, and you'll get some land at $1,000 an acre and some at $10, and maybe the last little bit you'll pay $50,000 an acre, but it'll just be a little bit of land. And your average price will be $3,000 an acre. In these markets, whatever is the highest price needed to get the last unit of electricity goes to everybody. So Enron's law allowed the following. It allowed the utilities to take their power plants, remove them from the regulated monopoly company, put them over here in the competitive market. So notice, same power plant, same location, same power, same customers, different pocket. Moved it from this pocket to that pocket. Now they're selling electricity back into the market. Now, if you only own one power plant, if you're a little merchant investor, you know, all of us got together and decided, okay, we'll each put up $100, we're going to invest in a power plant. We wanted that thing to run all the time because we got to pay for it. But what if you own 40 or 80 or 100 power plants? You can take some of them offline. They need to be repaired. Or you make a bid that's so high, nobody buys your power. And lo and behold, you end up paying $990 for power that if it was at the average price, would have cost $30. This is not a market. You can call it a market. Remember what Abraham Lincoln said about a cow's tail? Supposedly, you call a cow's tail a fifth leg, doesn't make it a fifth leg. These are not markets. These are devices to drive up prices to consumers and enrich the people who own these plants. Now, curiously, a lot of these people who got into this area of power have gone broke. Why would that happen if you get this huge subsidy from a rigged market? Well, Adam Smith told us about that. He said you would expect that people get a big subsidy from the government would have huge profits, but they don't. They often go broke because instead of chasing the business, they chase the subsidy. And because once it's not your money at risk, rash adventurers who don't know how to husband their resources are drawn into the market because there's no risk to them. So what's happened to the pricing of electricity in this country is it's gone through the roof. Well, it's costing jobs. During the California energy crisis, legislators in California, Oregon, and Washington were being besieged by phone calls. Business owners, school districts, individuals. And so a few weeks after the Bush administration came into office, Vice President Cheney met in the sub-basement of the U.S. Senate with the Northwest delegation. He had one rule for coming to the meeting. No Californians allowed in the room. They all sit down, and both Democrats and Republicans start telling the vice president these horror stories. And as they're doing this, the door suddenly opens, and a congressman named Jay Inslee, former prosecutor and inveterate basketball player, slides into the room, sees one empty chair, and being a great basketball player, he just slides into that chair and sits down, and lo and behold, he's face-to-face with Dick Cheney, whom he's never met. And as they go around the room telling their stories, Republicans and Democrats alike, one of the speakers says, look, I've got thousands of people who've been thrown out of work because of the electricity prices. Grocery stores that say they can't keep frozen food because they can't afford to run the refrigerators. somebody points out old ladies who've had their power shut off. And then somebody points out, hey, look, we've got poor families that have had their power shut off and they're using candles. And you know, it's just a matter of time until there's an awful fire and a bunch of children die. And all through this, Congressman Inslee watches and Cheney doesn't care. It's eminently clear to him that he doesn't care. And he understands, because who he thinks Cheney is, that he doesn't care about the little old ladies. But when they start talking about the business owners, now he's completely confused. Because in his mind, Mr. Cheney is a business guy. How can he be indifferent to the concerns of these business owners? Well, finally, Inslee is one of the most junior members of the delegation. His turn comes, and he was late because he was waiting for a fax. And he says, I have this fax here. I want to show you. And he slides it across the table, and he says, Mr. Vice President, this fact shows that even though record high prices were available for power in California yesterday, one-third of the power plants were shut down. Now, of course, when you get record high prices, who stops selling? That makes no sense. And Cheney, without looking at the piece of paper, and I interviewed a whole bunch of the congressmen who were in the room about this in both parties, slides it back to Inslee and says, you know what your problem is, Congressman? You don't know anything about economics. Anybody want to guess what Mr. Inslee's college degree is in? How many of you own a home? Do you remember the first time you bought a house? Maybe it's the only one you ever bought. How wonderful that felt? I can easily recall. I was 22 years old. My parents never owned a home. My dad was 100% disabled veteran. My own money, I went and bought a house. Just sold last year because it was in Silicon Valley for $1 million. Just a little stucco, two-bedroom, three-bath starter house. But I was so proud. I had 20% down. I went and I got a loan. And when you have all these pieces of paper stuck in front of you, sign this, initial that, sign this, you know, then they say an hour later, okay, it's yours. You go home and you look at that paperwork and you'll suddenly notice that there's one really big item on it. It's typically half the price you paid for the house. So it's a $200,000 house. It'll be about $1,000. It's called land title insurance. What the hell is land title insurance? Well, it's to guarantee that if somebody comes along and has put a lien on the property you didn't know about, or claims they have an interest in it, or the right to drill an oil well in your backyard, that you're protected, or should we say if it's a 20% down, the bank is protected. And it adds about 0.5%. By the way, the value of residential housing in the United States, owner-occupied, including second homes, is around $20 trillion before the current meltdown. So 0.5% is a lot of money. Well, turns out that 90 cents on the dollar of what you pay, 900 of that $1,000, does not go to buy title insurance. It goes to pay bribes and kickbacks, or what are politely called referral fees. This is what economists call a reverse market. In a normal market, the pressure is to push prices down. In a reverse market, the pressure is to push prices up. And the reason for that is you're not the customer. You're just the schlub who writes the check. In the land title system, if you go to the phone book and open it up, in most cities you'll see page after page of land title companies. And you would think, this is an incredibly vibrant market. Look how many competitors there are. Well, in fact, five companies have 90% of the business. They just operate through lots of little different names. Those companies collect about $16 billion a year, four times what they were collecting in 1980. And how much do they pay out in claims? Less than a nickel per dollar of what you pay. One of these land title companies, in its report to shareholders and the government, said, our customers are lawyers, are real estate lawyers, mortgage brokers, appraisers, and real estate agents. Notice who's missing. You. You know, most of the world doesn't have land title insurance. They don't have it in Puerto Rico. They don't have it in Europe. They don't have it in Australia or New Zealand, and they do just fine. And the land title insurance companies now have a new idea they want to sell you. They want you, when you buy a used car, to buy used car title insurance. And guess what? Most of the money you pay won't go to you. It'll go to the car dealer or the salesman.